for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. French Impressionist Paul Cézanne painted more than 950 works of art. He's considered one of the greatest painters of all time, but most of his success came after his death in 1906. Rejected by the Paris Salon for most of his life, he sold paintings only to close friends and fellow artists. In a new biography, author Alex Danchev writes about Cézanne's struggle with self-doubt, his revolutionary technique, and the family he kept secret. Alex Danchev joins me from a studio at WBEZ in Chicago. I hope you'll join us as well. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, sir, and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Alex Danchev, you are a professor of international relations. I'm fascinated that you've chosen to write this biography of the life of Cézanne.
Well, I try to combine the realms of art, broadly speaking, and politics and history and international relations, broadly speaking. It seems to me that artists have something to tell us that other people can't or don't, and I want to try and explore that.
And your book begins with the Autumn Salon in Paris in 1907. Can you talk about that?
Yes. The Salon was an annual exhibition in Paris, the annual exhibition in Paris, I suppose. And the 1907 one is special because it was the first ever exhibition of Cézanne's work in Paris in strength. So there were 56 Cézanne paintings, which was probably at that stage more Cézanne's than anyone had ever seen. Cézanne had died the previous year, so this was in effect the first retrospective exhibition, the first posthumous exhibition, and everyone went from all over Europe, from the United States, from all over the world. Some people went every day.
And why, up until that point, had his work been rejected by the Salon?
I think partly because of the way he painted and partly because of the life he lived. He painted, I guess, like nobody had ever painted before. It seemed to many people that they were seeing something very strange when they were looking at a Cézanne painting. Things might be at an odd angle. He said of himself that he was a painter by inclination, which was partly his little joke, I think, an acknowledgement that things in Cézanne paintings tended to lean in unexpected ways. The colours were strange. Trees might be blue, sky might be green. He mixed them up. He paid attention to every part of the canvas, so the bottom right corner might be tremendously important in a Cézanne painting and not the middle. And he painted everything. He painted apples like other people painted kings. So Cézanne paintings looked strange, bizarre. And I think that was part of the problem that people had with them. But that was also the fascination of them.
But you also talked about the life he lived as being another aspect of the rejection of the Salon. What kind of life?
Yes, Cézanne came from Aix-en-Provence in the south, and he came to Paris only rarely. He lived a kind of elusive, almost barbarian life, in the sense that he didn't like to take part in the salon, the café society. Café wit bored him. He lived outside a lot. He walked enormously. He walked all over the place. So he became a kind of tramp, almost. A sort of outsider figure. A legendary figure. Because painters in particular heard that he was doing something extraordinary. But very few of them had met him, and very few of them understood him.
Now, when you talk about his becoming almost a tramp, the ideas in my mind go back then to his childhood and what was going on there that could possibly have moved him in that direction, that is, to be free, to be outside, to be without boundaries.
Yes, he had a very good education in Aix. He was probably the best educated, certainly the most intelligent painter, European painter of his generation. This is a man who had studied the classics profoundly, who translated Latin and Greek in his spare time. He read Virgil, for example, Lucretius, all the classical poets, all his life. He read current French literature. He knew much of Baudelaire by heart. He read poetry with a passion. And one of the people that he went to school with, his greatest school friend, was Zola, the French novelist.
Émile Zola.
Yes, and these two men grew up tremendously close, the best of friends. So, on the one hand, there is the Cézanne who roams the countryside, who is, as you say, exactly free, untrammeled, unbound by convention. And on the other hand, here is a man who is tremendously intelligent, well-read, witty, ironic. People did not know how to take him, I think. They didn't know often whether he was being serious or whether he was being funny.
And yet, even as you talk about the odd angles, the colors, the use of every part of the canvas, what is it that you believe there is or was in Cézanne's temperament that made his paintings so great?
I think for Cézanne, painting was the way of truth-telling, of revealing the truth to us in a way that it had not been revealed before. So for Cézanne, it was a matter of tremendous importance to paint in the way that he saw, but also the way that he felt. He tried to communicate what he felt about things, I think. And that meant that he painted the same things over and over and over again because he felt slightly different about them on any given occasion. So there are 40 paintings of the famous mountain near his home, the Mont Saint-Victoire, near Aix. There are dozens of paintings of apples, of pears, of still life. There are dozens of paintings of his wife, of himself. He was one of the world's greatest self-portraitists. But I think in the end, he felt that he could try to capture the world, to remake the world, if you like, with a brushstroke or two. Renoir, his great contemporary, said, "How does he do it? He has only to put one dab of colour on a canvas and it's already something."
Cézanne, A Life is the biography by Alex Danchev. We're talking about, if you'd like to join us, call us now, 800-433-8850. Please know that if you do go to drshow.org, we have a number of Cézanne's paintings, reproductions on our website, and Basket of Apples is on our show page. You know, you talked about his self-portraits. In this book, Alex Danchev, there are numerous self-portraits. Why do you think he did so many?
I think he was fascinated by his own appearance, by the passage of time, also perhaps by the thought that in this way he could commune with previous masters. Cézanne liked Chardin, for example. He liked Rembrandt. And I think that he felt that by doing self-portraits in the way that they had, he formed a sort of link in a chain. He talks about it in those terms at one stage. So on the one hand, he wanted to paint as no one had painted before. He wanted to create a new way of painting. But on the other hand, he wanted to stand on the shoulders of previous masters.
Alex Danchev, he's Professor of International Relations at the University of Nottingham in England. His new book is titled Cézanne, A Life. And we'll take a short break here and be right back. And welcome back. Alex Danchev joins me by ISDN and Skype from WBEZ in Chicago. And we're talking about his brand new biography of Cézanne and his extraordinary life and art. Cézanne, as you've said in the book, was a late bloomer. Alex, why was it that he had no artistic training, as many of the young artists of the day did by working as an apprentice? He did none of that. Why do you think the art became such a passion for him, considering the breadth of his education?
His father wanted him to be a lawyer, and when he left school, in obedience to the father, he started out in law school. But he couldn't stand it and left after a year in
disobedience of his father.
Indeed. There's a nice joke later on in his life where he calls himself a doctor of law, the great painter. So I think he didn't know at first exactly what he wanted to do or how he wanted to do it. He tried twice, I believe, to get into the school in Paris, the École des Beaux-Arts, and twice he was rejected.
Because he had no formal training?
Yes, probably he was too indisciplined even at that early stage. He said himself that he couldn't put it all together, that he said, when a head interests me, I make it too big. And it's true that whenever he got intensely interested in any given part of the body or any given thing, he tended to make it too big. Listeners may like to try this out by looking at portraits he made or pictures that he made and see if they can spot that effect. So he never had a very good art school training. He had a little in Aix, but never in Paris. And above all, he never had an apprenticeship, as you say, with a major painter, as many of the great painters did, Manet, for example. And I think he always regretted that. But it meant that... Sorry.
No, go ahead. Forgive me.
I was just going to say that I think that meant that it took him even longer to acquire the necessary techniques and discipline and practice. And a lot of that came with his friendship with Pizarro, the great impressionist. Pizarro recognized Cézanne's genius from the outset in a way that many other people did not. And the two men became great friends. And Cézanne stood by Pizarro later on when he, Pizarro, was shunned by many of his fellows because he was Jewish.
Oh, my. I want to ask you about apples. And Cézanne had a fascination with apples. How did that begin, and why do you think he concentrated so wonderfully and beautifully on apples?
Cézanne himself said in old age that Cézanne's apples go back a long way. And I think what he meant was that when he and Zola were at school together in Aix, Zola was bullied by the other children. Zola was a little mama's boy, and Cézanne was a big ruffian. Huh. And Cézanne stood up for Zola. He protected him. And one day, Zola brought Cézanne a box of apples as a thank you. So apples became for them a kind of bond, a seal of their friendship.
And
I think that from then on...
That friendship you talk about lasted from almost cradle to grave.
Yes. There's a huge controversy about how it ended or didn't end or changed later in their lives. When Zola became famous as a novelist, one of the novels that he wrote was a book called L'Œuvre in French, The Masterpiece. And The Masterpiece concerns a painter called Claude Lantier, who bears a striking resemblance to a certain painter called Paul Cézanne. And Zola's character, Lantier, is a kind of failed genius who eventually hangs himself in front of his unfinished and unfinishable masterpiece. And so the theory has always been that this book and this portrayal of such a painter so offended Cézanne, so affected him, that the friendship broke in the mid-1880s, when the two men were in their 40s. I think that theory is wrong, because I think Cézanne understood perfectly well that Zola was writing a novel and was not writing a memoir or trying to send him a message.
But what is the evidence either that the friendship ended or that the relationship continued?
Something changed. the two men had corresponded intensively for most of their early lives. And we have most of these letters. They're a marvellous source about Cézanne and his life and beliefs. But after that book came out, their correspondence stopped. So something changed. But I think that we need to understand that Cézanne didn't need to be near his friends. I mentioned that he was close to Pizarro, the artist. Cézanne and Pizarro didn't meet for 10 or 20 years at a time, and neither of them thought that was odd. Proximity was not necessary to Cézanne's conduct of relationships. And even in a certain way, life. Cézanne felt very close to people who had lived in the classical period.
I know the feeling well. I must say, you write that every year Cézanne would submit his canvases to the Salon, and every year for 20 years he was rejected, even though his fellow artists, Monet, Gauguin, Renoir, loved him and bought his paintings, thought he was a genius, and yet he was largely unknown to the public. How could that be?
The Salon at that time was a very conservative affair. It was governed by artists who had already exhibited in the Salon. In other words, it was a kind of club which regulated its own membership. And it was very loath to admit new people, new ways of seeing, new ways of painting. So it is true that all these major artists, Renoir, Monet, Pizarro, Gauguin, Degas, all collected Cézanne and were fascinated by him, as you said. But the official Salon never recognised him and always felt that this was a kind of barbarian art. But I think the interesting question is what Cézanne himself thought about this. It's true that he might have liked the recognition that came with being in the Salon, but I think it is also true that it became a kind of game with him, an annual sport or campaign, and he expected to be rejected.
Does he leave notes about that? Does he write to his friends to talk about this so-called game?
Yes, he says, I have had a letter as expected. I continue as normal.
What about his personal life, Alex? He did marry, did he not?
Yes, he met a young girl in Paris of very humble origins in about 1869. So when he was about 30 and she was about 19. Her name was Hortense. And they lived together. They had a child together. But they didn't marry formally, officially, until about 20 years later. And the reason they didn't marry was that Cézanne's father strongly disapproved of her. And Cézanne, at the time, was living very largely on an allowance from his father, since, apart from anything else, he couldn't sell any paintings. He could hardly give them away. And so he was afraid that if he married the girl, if he was open about this relationship, that he would be disinherited by his father. So he had a kind of secret family for much of his middle years.
How did his friends feel about her?
They knew about her, that she was not secret from them. and they tended rather to make fun of her. They called her la boule, meaning the ball, or perhaps the dumpling, and they called his son the little dumpling. So I think this is a way of deriding her, really. I don't think Cézanne used these nicknames, but I think he must have known about them.
You know, it seems so interesting that while Cézanne's father wanted him to be an attorney, a lawyer, his mother really supported his art, encouraged him, and he felt very close to her.
Yes, I think that's right. His mother is a rather shadowy presence. We know very little about her. There are no letters in her hand, as far as I know. She certainly could read. Cézanne wrote to her regularly, but she seems not to have written back. But yes, they were very close. And I think that his mother must have found ways of negotiating the marriage she was in to her husband, who was a very dominating, domineering character. He must have been very difficult to live with, Cézanne's father. But the mother indeed supported Cézanne throughout. Cézanne was very keen to find what he called moral support. And he got that, I think, from his mother, from one or two painters, not very many, from Zola, and from books.
Alex Danchev, his new biography is titled Cézanne, A Life. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have a great many callers waiting. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, George. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'm in northern Kentucky, right across the river. Beautiful day here. I just wanted to mention that the author's already touched on this a little bit, the idea repeatedly, and you mentioned it yourself, subject matter. And as an artist, I've read his story, quite a bit of writing of Cézanne, and I've always been fascinated by this idea. I wonder if the author has wondered if it was just the fact that Cézanne always felt like he never quite could achieve perfection in the work that he was doing. There's a story, and I mentioned this earlier, there's a story about Cézanne on a painting exhibition, either with another impressionist or perhaps someone that he knew, and that this person was out painting also, and walking home came across a Cézanne that was a canvas just basically thrown in the forest. Apparently he was upset with it, not good enough. Of course, I probably would have picked up that canvas, but I just wonder if the artist or if the author could just broach that subject again, whether he really thinks it is the idea of painting a subject over and over again from different viewpoints, or that from Cézanne's writings, and he was just sometimes very frustrated.
What do you think?
Shall I pick that up?
Please.
Yes, that's a very good question. I think that's absolutely right. It seems clear that he did throw away paintings when he was out in the countryside or even in Aix. There's a great story of somebody digging up a Cézanne canvas, a little like an archaeological find. So it's a marvellous thing to think that Cézanne was laying down, sedimenting art in his own country. And there's another wonderful story about a canvas that was in a fruit tree for several years at a time before it was harvested, so to speak, by the artist.
But is that because he was such a perfectionist or so insecure about his own work that he was simply frustrated, dissatisfied, couldn't quite achieve the vision he had in his heart?
I think it's mostly frustration, but sometimes perfection too. Hmm. I think sometimes he felt that he had arrived at something, And that was as far as he could go in any given canvas. And when he'd done that, it was over. He needed to move on to the next one.
But why wouldn't he at least give that painting to someone rather than throw it away?
Yes, I'm not sure about the answer to that.
Really a tough one. If I were out there, I would have been climbing trees and digging.
Absolutely.
As well. Short break here, and as we come back, we have many phone calls. We'll try to get to as many of you as we can. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by REI, with gear and advice for a lifetime of outdoor adventure and stewardship since 1938, in stores and at REI.com. By Carbonite, providing automatic cloud backup with anytime, anywhere access for individuals and small businesses. Details at Carbonite.com. And by Angie's List, with local reviews of roofers, doctors, auto shops, and yard care. More at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
Mary Lou Henner always knew she could recall specific details from long ago. Then she discovered that ability was rare. The actress on her autobiographical memory. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour.
And welcome back. If you've just joined us, Alex Danchev is with me. He's professor of international relations at the University of Nottingham in England. He joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. His new book is titled Cézanne, A Life. And here's a tweet from someone who identifies him or herself as Alpine Joy. The question being, since Cézanne and Zola were friends, did Cézanne have a point of view regarding the Dreyfus affair?
That's a good question. Cézanne was on the wrong side of the Dreyfus affair in the sense that he was an anti-Dreyfusard. Whereas, of course, Zola was a Dreyfusard, a pro-Dreyfusard.
Give us a brief sketch of the Dreyfus affair.
Dreyfus was an officer in the French army who was accused of being a traitor. And it was a trumped-up charge, very largely because Dreyfus was Jewish. And the affair, as it was called in France, split the country tremendously. Zola published a famous front-page article, J'accuse, I accuse. And what he accused was he accused the state, the government, officials of persecuting Dreyfus. So people split into two camps, one in favour of Dreyfus and Zola, and on the side of, if you like, liberalism, and the other who were prepared to believe that Dreyfus was a traitor, who were often anti-Semitic or reactionary.
Now, how would that have affected the relationship between Cézanne and Zola to be on opposite sides of that?
Well, the two camps were not entirely monolithic. There were divisions between them. And so, for example, Zola's son-in-law was anti-Semitic and anti-Dreyfusar. So it was possible sometimes for people to tolerate the fact that they were on opposite sides. And Cézanne's position, though anti-Dreyfusar, was not anti-Semitic. I mentioned a little earlier that he always supported Pizarro, a Jew, throughout that period, whilst, for example, Renoir and Degas were virulently anti-Semitic and cut Pizarro in the street. Cézanne referred to himself as a pupil of Pizarro to underline his solidarity.
Huh. Interesting. All right, to Forestville, Maryland. Good morning, Maria.
Good morning. I want to first thank the author for writing this book. I haven't read it yet, but I look forward to it. I was an art teacher for almost 9 years, and the way I introduced my students to painting was actually by having them copy some of Cézanne's still lives, usually the apples. And it seemed to take a lot of the stress of painting and being able to mix the colors. So I'm really delighted that this is being discussed. As an art teacher and a painter, I felt that I was fairly familiar with where I could find his work and see it in person, mostly, obviously, at the National Gallery in New York and some places in Europe. But last year, quite by accident, I went to see the Barnes Foundation to see it before it was moved to its new location, and I was surprised to find a treasure trove of the Barnes that I did not know existed so close. I wondered if the author came across any of the research or any of the information about Dr. Barnes, Albert Barnes, and how his collecting of Barnes' work in the United States affected the art scene here.
Thank you, Maria.
Yes, another very good question. There are more Cézannes in Philadelphia than there are in France.
Huh.
There are a huge number of Cézannes in the Barnes collection, as your caller says, and also some tremendous Cézannes in the Philadelphia Museum of Art just up the street. Barnes was remarkable. He had almost unlimited resources, as you will know, and he had tremendous taste. He was a most difficult and peculiar man, but goodness me, he knew how to buy good art, and he bought dozens of Cézannes at a time when very, very few people were collecting Cézanne in strength.
How interesting. All right, Maria, there you are. To Richard in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Diane. I'm fascinated with this conversation. It happens that I am working on a documentary of the 1913 Armory Show, which your guest will know. And I'm actually looking at a photostat of the entry card, several entry cards of the paintings which were brought over for that show in New York. And at some point, of course, when you're discussing somebody like Cézanne, you always get to price. And I thought you would be interested to know that the insured price for one of his most famous paintings in 1913, which was Old Woman with Rosary, which is now at the National Gallery in London, was $48,600. And today, of course, it probably could not be purchased. So I just thought that it's an interesting comment on the constantly inflating value of these magnificent artists.
Indeed. Richard, thank you for your call. Do you agree that at this point that piece would probably be priceless?
Yes. The Armory Show of 1913 was, I think, the first public exhibition of Cézanne's here in the US, and tremendously important. Very interesting to hear about the price. 100 years later, one of Cézanne's card players' paintings has been bought by the Emir of Kuwait for $250 million.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Here's an email from Carolyn, who says, didn't Cézanne, as many other poor artists of his day, paint himself because he could not afford to pay a model?
Oh, that's a very good suggestion. I think in this instance, Cézanne was not well off, but he did have a little more money than some. But what he didn't like was working with a live model in the studio, somebody, a stranger, if you like. He found that upsetting, off-putting. So he very, very rarely used models on the conventional way.
What you're saying is he was somewhat uncomfortable with having a live model, that was detrimental in some way to his painting?
Yes, a stranger, especially a naked stranger.
I see.
And especially a naked woman.
All right, well, here's a question to follow up on that. What was Cézanne's fascination with the woman standing, bending, perhaps playing in the sea waves? He created several such paintings, and they now seem somehow archetypal. But of what? And before you respond, let me just tell our listeners that they can see something like this with the large bather's painting as part of our Cézanne gallery at drshow.org. Go right ahead, Alex.
Yes, in the last 10 years of his life, he painted 3 versions of these large bathers, as they're called. One is in the Barnes collection, one is in the Philadelphia Museum of Art, excuse me, and one is in the National Gallery in London. They're vast paintings, and he'd been planning these paintings for years. He built a studio in 1901, a few years before he died, and in the studio wall, he had a kind of giant vertical letterbox so that huge canvases could be passed in and out through the wall. In other words, he was planning these paintings for a very long time. And he planned, I think, to make paintings that would go in the world's great museums. And these were paintings not of any particular persons or models, but paintings out of his imagination. They were dreamscapes, and they were fed, I think, by the stories that he read in the classical world, by the people in Virgil, and not the people in France.
Interesting. Here's an email from Susan, who's listening to the program while, as she puts it, working on her humble paintings. She says, I have to confess, I'm confounded that Cézanne's desire to obliterate his unsuccessful work is a mystery to you and your guest, as it seems so obvious to me when someone strives in their work to make a good, really good painting to satisfy their own idea of good. It's like putting yourself on the canvas, and it doesn't measure up. If it doesn't measure up, it has to be removed from anyone's gaze. It cannot live.
What a marvelous suggestion. I think that for many of the painters and philosophers and writers who came after him, it's that very idea that appeals to them so much about Cézanne. The idea that what you see in a Cézanne picture is in fact Cézanne the man. Hmm. That, as Braque said, he risked his life every time he painted a picture.
Oh my. What was his life like after his father died?
His father died in 1886, and so Cézanne then had about 20 more years to live. For a while, he lived, I think, much as he had before, but during the last 10 years of his life, he cut himself off from other people with an almost ruthless abandon. He lived a lot of the time in a huge quarry near Aix, where he got very close to the land, very close to the earth. Cézanne was in every sense well-earthed. He understood the land. He became friends with trees. He communed with the mountain. He saw some people, but not very many. And other painters would come and try to find him, as if on a pilgrimage. They'd try and listen to him and learn.
He developed arthritis, diabetes.
Yes.
How did that affect him?
Well, it's a little difficult to know. We don't have any medical records. He made no secret of it. And he sometimes complained of certain things. He complained about headaches, intense headaches, which just occasionally stopped him painting, but not often. One of the interesting things to speculate about is how it affected his vision. And we don't really know, but we do know that it could have altered the vision. If you have diabetes, you sometimes have colour blindness of various kinds, or partial blindness. And so the speculation has always been whether he saw things differently, perhaps more less clearly, more fuzzily. But I don't really think that we can use the diabetes to explain the painting.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How did he die?
Cézanne vowed that he would die painting, and he did. He was caught in a thunderstorm outside one day near Aix, and he must have become unconscious, and he was out there in the rain and the wind for several hours until he happened to be found by a passing laundryman on his cart, and so he was brought back in and taken to his room, and it was clear that he was in mortal danger. He carried on painting for a day or two. We have his last watercolour, which is absolutely magnificent painting.
My goodness.
Which he was stationed next to his bed, and he would get up every so often as he could and put another dab or two of colour on the painting. And he was also working on one of the last paintings of his gardener, Vallier, who became a kind of second self, I think, very close to him. So he was painting till the end, and one morning he simply expired. And so, in a certain way, he achieved what he had wanted, which
was
paint until the end.
Yes, exactly. You regard him as perhaps the greatest painter the world has ever known.
Yes, I think he was unquestionably the greatest modern artist, acknowledged as such by practically every other artist in the 20th century, unquestionably the most influential modern artist, and unquestionably also the artist who's most influential beyond art as a kind of exemplary figure for so many writers, philosophers, thinkers, dreamers. It is really Cézanne who is the exemplary artist creator of the modern age.
Cézanne, A Life. That's the title of Alex Danchev's new biography containing some glorious reproductions of Cézanne's work. You will find several in our own gallery at drshow.org. Alex Danchev, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to talk with you.
A privilege. Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Jill Colgan. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yurov-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.